With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Whether you're looking to buy your dream home or rent a sweet apartment, give Redfin your gotta-have-it wish list of property features, and you'll receive real-time notifications tailored just for you. Ready to see it up close and personal? Scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Don't wait to find your perfect match. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Where the Bodies Are Buried contains graphic depictions of violence that some listeners may find disturbing. Discretion is advised.
Before we kick this episode off, we wanted to let you know about this very special episode that you're about to hear on Where the Bodies Are Buried. We're really excited about an experience never ever seen in the podcast world that you can enjoy while listening to this episode. We've partnered with the number one destination for true crime, the Crime Door app, to offer our listeners a groundbreaking experience and visually walk through an amazing augmented reality experience of the crime scene of serial killer Todd Kohlhepp, the killer realtor. Go to the award-winning Crime Door app and download it right now. Go to the AR door link at the bottom and click on it. You'll see the Kayla Brown door, Todd Kohlhepp's final victim, who miraculously survived, and where his reign of terror came to an end. And these doors are one-of-a-kind augmented reality experiences. And if you click on the door and purchase it for $199 using your phone or tablet, you'll be able to walk into the crime scene as the authorities found her. It's been recreated in painstaking detail. Everything from Kayla herself, to the chain around her neck and wrists, to the book and food and cleaning products that littered the area. Go to the Crime Door app and download while listening to this episode.
My name is Phil Chalmers, and this is Where the Bodies Are Buried.
The devil is on my side.
Joining me is my producers, Adam and Samantha.
Todd Kohlhepp's disturbing life of violent crime started at a young age. When he was only 15, he was charged as an adult for the kidnapping and raping of a 14-year-old, which resulted in a 14-year prison stint and put him on the sexual offenders registry. When released, he didn't wait long to start murdering people, including unleashing terror in a motorcycle shop and killing four. But none of this stopped him from earning two bachelor's degrees in computer science and business and becoming a successful real estate broker. By 2016, he had murdered countless people. But this all came to an end in November of 2016 when investigators tracked a missing person's cell phone to his 100-acre property in South Carolina. The investigators found a young woman in a scene straight from a horror film. She was chained up in a storage locker for months, clinging to life. Now, he tells us these stories very matter-of-factly as he justifies why he does it and how he thinks no one will miss them. Although he's convicted of killing seven people in the Carolinas, the numbers are much higher and spanned all the way to Mexico. Listen carefully, because maybe you can help us solve the murder of two men he describes killing in early 2003.
You have a prepaid call from
Todd,
an inmate at South Carolina Department of Corrections.
Hey, Todd, how you doing?
Good morning.
So we're talking to Todd Kohlhepp. Todd Kohlhepp, former realtor. Todd, is it okay if I record you?
Yes, go ahead.
Todd, some people call you the serial killer realtor, which I find interesting. You were born in 1971 in Florida. You had a little bit of turmoil growing up with your parents. Your parents got divorced at a young age when you were like 2 years old. You had a stepdad at three. Talk about just your early upbringing, your family, your early upbringing in Florida.
Born in Florida, when I had my parents immediately split up. My mom went back, took me back to Atlanta to be with her parents. And she tried to basically raise a son. Got a job, went on from there. Didn't see my dad until I was four. My mom decided to remarry. My dad was her second husband. And she was going to marry Carl, who was her third husband. Overall, she's married nine times.
You didn't have a lot of stability growing up, is what you're saying.
No. My family, pretty much my mom was constantly looking for a new husband, having issues with the kids, what she wanted out of life. And I got passed on to my grandparents a lot. My grandparents did not want to be grandparents, mm-hmm. never wanted to be grandparents. And were pretty upset that they were even parents. They did not like her. And they definitely did not like me because by being grandparents, it made them feel old.
So, Todd, at the age of 4, you're starting to show aggression towards other children in nursery school. At the age of 9, you start counseling. You're explosive to others, and you have, they say you were preoccupied with sexual content at the age of 9. Cruelty to animals, you shot a dog, you killed a goldfish with Clorox. And by the age of 10 or 11, you're spending time in a Georgia psychiatric hospital. Is that all true, and can you talk about that?
Yes, and no, it's not true.
Okay.
I was in the Georgia State Mental Institution when I was 9 for 3.5 months due to my aggression.
Okay.
I was having a hard time getting along with other kids, so they put me there with other kids who also couldn't get along.
Okay.
I was there for 3.5 months where I stayed basically doped up on Thorazine and all kinds of little amitriptyline and all these little pills they would give you all day. All the kids were like zombies. I did not shoot the dog. My neighbor shot the dog with a BB gun, and then I got blamed for it. I got beat for it, and everybody wanted to blame me. And then later on, after I got stopped being grounded, I went over and beat that kid, and then I tried to poison him because it pissed me off that I got punished for what he did. The goldfish I did, but it's not what everybody thinks. I had a 1-gallon tank with one fish in it that didn't have any filter. It was just a big glass bowl, and it got algae in it. And my mother told me that I could not go outside and play until I cleaned the tank. I didn't want to do it. I was 12 years old, and what my idea was, if they put chlorine in a pool to keep the pool clean, well, I'll just put a little bit of bleach in the water, splash the water with a little bit of bleach. That's chlorine. It'll go ahead and it'll clean the tank, and I can go out and play. When I come back, it'll all be clean. No, I'm not cruel to animals at all.
Well, do you think the reason for these later crimes, Todd, do you think the anger that you might have comes from some of your upbringing?
I imagine it did. I mean, I had a very violent childhood. At 5 years old, my grandfather thought it was funny to hit me with a cattle prod. Anytime that he'd catch me walking around, he would either zap me or zap my mother with a cattle prod. From the time I was 8, when I was living with him, they would drag me by the hair outside, tie me to a tree, and beat me. All of the men in my mom's life, except for the last one, all of them were hyper-aggressive, military-based jackasses.
Gotcha.
The last one was a pushover. The last one was a pushover, but all the ones before that were not. They made it crystal clear that I was the redheaded stepchild, that I really wasn't wanted in the house, and they made it crystal clear about that. You know, I wanted to go to a foster home. My dad was very violent, very proud to be violent, and he wanted me to be violent. At any given time, I was pushed into fights around my neighborhood, and at no time could I ever do right. If I engaged, I went too far. If I didn't engage, what's wrong with you? Are you scared? Why did you not engage?
Todd, were you ever sexually abused? Because if you're 9 years old, they're saying you're thinking about sexual content. Were you sexually abused growing up by anybody?
I was not. I was verbally abused. I was physically. I was never sexually.
Okay. So Todd, at the age of 12, you did move out to live with your bio dad, your real dad, in Arizona. You got into weapons and stuff. You got in a little bit of trouble when you were 15 years old. You committed your first felony, your first crime. Yes. Talk about what happened on November 25th, 1986. You're 15 years old.
My dad was gone for a week. He had to go to Dayton, Ohio, left me by myself. I'm dating one girl 1 week, and then the next week, another girl, and none of us did anything. At the biggest point, it was maybe touchy-feely. You know, I'll touch yours, you touch mine. I went over. I had a girl 3 doors down from me, and we had been on again, off again, kind of dating. It was a really kind of an over-the-top word, but we were seeing, you know, back and forth. And then she started dating a 22-year-old. She dated a lot of older guys. She was 14. She was dating a 22-year-old. Me and him got into it one day, and he promptly beat my ass. He was very prominent about carrying around a little .38. He always carried a gun. He didn't need it because, like I said, he beat my ass. And I went ahead later on. I wanted to go down and talk to her. But I went ahead and got one of my dad's Berettas, and I had it in my pants, and I went down to talk to her. And the intent was to have the gun on me just in case I had a run-in with him. I figured I'd flash this thing at him, yeah, you're not the only one with a gun. Do what you got to do. He was never there. She came out. We talked. In the middle of it, I got her to come down the side of her house, had the alley, got her to come down it, at which point in time I talked her into coming to my house. I did pull the gun out. I'd never pointed the gun at her, nor did I ever pull the trigger. So all the reports of me pulling a trigger on her never happened. Did take her to my house, and my intent was to have a discussion with her. I had been drinking. I was 15. I knew my dad was coming home. I knew I had an ass beating for something coming. And while he was gone for a week, I had decided to basically get into the liquor cabinet. First time drinking whiskey. Not the best move. While I do take full blame for what happened, I will say the alcohol definitely didn't help matters with decision making. But took her down to my house. In the process of it, I seriously misspoke, seriously misacted, ended up tying her up, and I did rape her. That was entirely my fault.
You tied her up and you had sexual intercourse with her?
Yes.
And you took her back to her house and said, if you tell, I'm going to kill your siblings or something like that.
That I did say. My dog, when I let her out of the house, my dog got out of the door, went run around the neighborhood. Me and her ran around the neighborhood trying to get the dog. She helped me get the dog. Once I had the dog, the police department pulled up in the front yard of her house, and she went over to them, and I immediately broke left and went back to my house. Had the dog, getting away from the cops. Of course, a few minutes later, they're at my front door. I barricaded the door. I wasn't going to come out. Was pretty much along the lines of, no, I'll just stay here. I'll just stay here until this all blows over, which...
Yeah,
it's not going to blow over, but when you're 15, you're not thinking that.
You were arrested at the age of 15 and 16. You went to prison.
15.
Yeah, you went to prison for...
Yes.
You got a 15-year sentence, but you did 14 years, and you got out at the age of 30. That's a long time, by the way, and that's a weird place to grow up, from 16 to 30. But you did make... You had a few rough years, but you did make the best of it. You got a GED, college degree. Was prison... What was that like for a guy your age?
Definitely different. I had never been in trouble before. I had never been in juvie. And all of a sudden now I went from minors unit to immediately go into an adult prison. So I actually did the full 15 years. There was no parole.
Okay.
Because they gave me the back time for me being in jail.
Okay.
And the minors are literally, it's gladiator school. If you're not fighting today, you will be fighting tomorrow. There are people in there getting stabbed. There are people getting raped. There's all kinds of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very volatile situation. I fought constantly the whole time I was there.
Wow.
And it wasn't a lot of fun, but I mean, I got through it. The night of my 18th birthday, you of course you get locked down for the night. And then the morning after, you move your stuff onto the adult yard. I was terrified because I thought, I mean, the guards tell you constantly that, you know, the adults are going to rape you, you know, Bubba's going to get you in the shower. I'm going to tell you, none of that happens. That is TV. I got lucky. A lot of the people I was around, Aryan Brotherhood, Mexican Mafia, Black Gorilla Family, all of the various gang leaders looked at me like basically they couldn't raise their own son. So they raised me.
Mm.
I didn't join anything. I just did my time. They tried to direct me towards getting an education.
Mm-hmm.
I did not get directed to go to a gang. I got directed to go to school, get a job, and try to become something and get out of the prison. So instead of steering me towards crime, mm-hmm. they steered me towards doing right.
You're released from prison at the age of 30, and you moved back to... South Carolina, where your mother is. You get a job as a graphic designer. You go back to college and, you know, you start getting another degree. You actually got another degree. But in the process of that, you had purchased a motorcycle and you didn't really like it or something happened and you wanted to take it back. So you took it back to the Superbike Motorsports in Chesney, South Carolina, November 6th, 2003. Uh-huh. You're 32 years old, Todd. What happens at that Superbike? Tell us exactly how it went down. From your words, what happened that day?
I bought the bike back in, I think it was in March. I bought the bike. The day that I got it, my grandmother died, so I couldn't even ride the bike. Didn't know how to ride it anyhow. They had sold me a Suzuki GSX 750,
yep.
And I didn't know how to ride it. They had to deliver the bike for me at my apartment complex. When I finally got to ride it, I literally didn't know how to do it. Was having a hard time, and I went back to them and asked them if they would consider taking it back and selling me a smaller bike. They said they considered it. They would consider it, and that was about it. They had been very rude to me when I was buying the bike. They were nice. Once I actually gave them the money for the bike, they were kind of like acting like assholes.
Okay,
which kind of surprised me. My mom's last husband was actually with me that day, and even he was surprised. And he's the one who talked him into bringing the bike to the apartment complex, because trying to get me out of that parking lot was going to get me killed.
Were you pissed? Were you pissed at that situation?
I was mostly excited to be getting the motorcycle.
Yeah.
I honestly thought in my stupid thoughts that I had a brand new crotch rocket and Asian chicks would rain from the sky to fall on top of my bike.
Okay.
I was excited to have my first motorcycle.
How does this happen in November 6th?
14 days later, my bike got stolen.
Okay.
I reported it. All that happened. Reported to law enforcement.
Yep.
Then I heard all over town that these bike shops, especially Superbike, has a long history of fraud, stealing motorcycles, chop shop, that the owner's father went to prison for having a car chop shop. And then he later on disappeared on the same road that his son died on. But okay. I went out to the bike shop to ask them, you know, basically accuse them of stealing my bike. All they had to do was tell me, look around. Do you see your bike? No. Then we ain't got your shit. That's mm-hmm. all you had to do.
What did they do?
Point around, is your bike here?
What did they do?
Instead, Brian Lucas, who was the co-partner with
Scott Ponder.
With Ponder.
Yep.
Looks at me. They're all in the front showroom.
Yep.
And he looks at me and tells me, fuck you. He tells me, fuck you. We took your bike. What are you going to do about it? I went, excuse me? He goes, you heard me. What are you going to do about it?
Okay.
Oh, no, no. You're not going to do that to me. I'm not your punk. I'm not your bitch. We're not playing this. Okay, well, I'm not really sure right this moment what I'm going to do about it. I'm definitely going to do something.
Right.
So I left. That was back in April.
Oh, so you left and that was it.
Got all pissed.
Okay.
Now, during this situation, I had another altercation with two other guys in my apartment complex that they were looking for those guys' bodies a couple years ago. But that's a different matter. We can come back to that another time. But after the bike got stolen, I had two guys, because I was on the six offender registry, who decided to attack me in a parking lot, mm-hmm. and I ended up killing them.
Todd, those are two unsolved murders right now?
Those are unsolved.
Okay.
I tried to show them where the bodies were, and the police they played games. Everywhere I told them everywhere I told them I had never been, they searched.
Okay.
Everywhere I told them that it might be where I put them, they refused to search. So I got frustrated and said, to hell with it.
7 months, this anger built up till November 6th. Holy crap.
I went back to the bike shop several times.
Okay.
I was pissed off, but I wasn't ready to kill anybody yet. I had already killed two people, and I was surprised I hadn't gotten busted for that. Even though they attacked me, I'm an ex-felon. I might as well assume I'm going to be arrested for it. I had never done that before, and I was kind of a wreck over it, because quite honestly, I didn't expect it. I didn't think it would go to that. And it was over with so fast, it wasn't even funny. And you never really know where to hide a body until you need to hide a body. And then you're panicking because every light you see looks like a cop car. And every time you come to a red light, you swear there's a camera on you. Try to hide a body one day. It will freak you out. Killing them was not hard. Trying to find a place to hide them, that was hard.
Todd Kohlhepp just admitted to a double homicide that is unsolved. I'm not sure I believe he did this or not. He could be making it up. We don't know. You know, I don't know if there are two men that are missing. I don't think there are, unless they're from out of state. To stab two men to death in front of an apartment building and then take the time to go in and get sheets and shower curtains and wrap them up and put them in a vehicle. It just, to me, it sounds kind of outlandish. Is it possible? Yes. Is it believable? I'm not sure.
Phil, what kind of person is Todd Kohlhepp? It seems like he had a really dysfunctional upbringing. Can you tell us a little more about him?
Yeah, I mean, he did have a dysfunctional upbringing. You know, his parents were divorced and he didn't grow up with the dad. We all know that that is the biggest connector of killers, whether they're mass murderers, school shooters, or even serial killers. But it seemed to affect him more. It seemed to impact him more. Like, he can't get along with other children. He's being aggressive towards other children. He's in trouble in nursery school to the point where I think it's around 10 or 11 years old, he has to go off to a psychiatric hospital. How many kids do you know that have been to a psychiatric hospital? And I think he spent like 3.5 months there. I don't know if that helped him or hurt him, but when he got out, he really wasn't fixed. He really wasn't rehabilitated. He wanted to live with his dad forever. His father kind of didn't want him, and his mother kind of didn't want him. Can you imagine you're in that situation where neither your parents want you? Eventually, at the age of 12, he is sent to live with his dad in Arizona. And unfortunately, 3 years later, he commits a very serious violent crime.
So Todd Kohlhepp committed his first major crime at the age of 15. He raped a girl and then went to prison for it at the age of 16. It seems like this guy was doomed from the get-go, right? I mean, how do you really come back from that?
I mean, yeah, how do you come back from that? You commit a crime at the age of 15 and you're sent to prison for 15 years. And he did do 15 years. I mean, he had to complete his entire sentence. And I can't imagine being in an adult prison at that age. I mean, he could have served 40 years, but they sentenced him to 15. All I know is he was not rehabilitated in prison. And so when Todd got out, he probably picked up a few tips along the way and learned a few things in prison and got out and was super obsessed with weapons and explosives and violence.
How scary is that? You're 16 years old and you just got sentenced to 15 years in prison.
But I feel like that's an appropriate punishment, right?
Oh, definitely appropriate punishment. And he did his 3.5 months in a psychiatric facility. I don't know what that's like, but that can't be too enjoyable either. But you're going to really go to the next level when you get sent to an adult prison. Can you imagine spending the most formative years of your life in prison from the age of 15 to the age of 30? I mean, think about all the things that happen for most people during that time. Todd Kohlhepp doesn't get to experience that part of life on the outside. So when he gets out, he's just a little different than everybody else. Coming up, more from Todd Kohlhepp, including the crimes that got him sent to prison for life.
And I just want to remind you guys to go to the Crime Door app and download it while you listen to this episode.
If you're looking for more serial killer and true crime content, check out my YouTube channel at True Crime Phil.
Later in this episode, you will hear the chilling details of Todd Kohlhepp's final victim who survived and which eventually led to Kohlhepp's arrest. Go to the Crime Door app and download it right now to walk through Todd Kohlhepp's final crime scene while you listen to this episode. Here are the step-by-step instructions to seeing the Kayla Brown augmented reality portal in the Crime Door app. First, download the Crime Door app. Once you're registered, go to the AR Doors link and click on it. Next, choose the Kayla Brown door, then make sure you are standing in an open area or room. Click on Activate AR Crime Door. Hold your phone or tablet out in front of you and move your device slowly across the floor of the room. Once you see the blue circle, make sure it is about 5 feet in front of you and then click on it. You're going to see a blue glowing doorway. Walk into it by walking with your device through it or using the joystick at the bottom of your screen. Go to the Crime Door app and download it right now. You'll be able to see every detail.
We're talking to Todd Kohlhepp, the serial killer realtor. He's already talked about his first crime, which he committed at the age of 15, and a double homicide that is still unsolved. He's now about to tell us about a crime that shocked South Carolina, a mass murder of 4 innocent people at a motorcycle shop.
But at the bike shop, I went back several times. I went back in about 2 months later, and I'm like, okay, I figured, you know, maybe with everybody calm down, maybe I was really pissed about the 8 words of, what are you going to do about it? And I'm like, okay, maybe Scott would come up. I knew Brian was a hothead. Maybe Scott would come over and talk to me and go, hey, you know, words were said. We didn't mean it. If they had said that, it would have been over with, because I never proved that they had my bike. Okay. Right. I only had what Brian's word of his mouth. I never proved anything. Instead, they were snickering and laughing when I came in, and Brian's like, oh, came back to get another one taken. You son of a bitch. You just couldn't let it go because you just had to poke one more time. See, all right. You want to know what I'm going to do. You got it. So I went and I made some phone calls, and I went home and I started calling. I could not find a gun anywhere to buy in South Carolina. I'm an ex-felon, and there's no private sales where they're in the newspapers here. In Arizona, there's 8 pages of guns for sale in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Here you got a shotgun and a hunting rifle. Well, that's not going to do me any good. So I made a phone call to Arizona, and I got connected back with an arms dealer out of Atlanta. I went out and I bought a Beretta 92 FS, which is what I was looking for. Okay. So I bought that gun. 7 months after the bike got stolen, I went on the November 6th.
November 6th. Walk me through it. What happens? What happens that day?
I was in Greenville Tech going to college. I was in an art history class. We had a test that day, which got me out of class a little bit early, because when you get done with the test, you can leave. So I went to school with full intent to do what I was going to do. I woke up that morning with a full intent of driving to Chesney and shooting these people.
Okay.
Immediately drove to Bowling Springs, which leads to Chesney, mm-hmm. and parked in the back of a CVS, where I put on my shoulder holster and put on the Beretta and the spare magazine underneath my armpit, and then I put a light Columbia fleece jacket over it. And I came into the front door, and everybody was in the front showroom talking to some man with his kid about a go-kart for Christmas, some layaway for Christmas. I don't shoot kids. Mm-hmm. If I have to leave and come back, I will leave and come back. I'm not going to engage somebody with a kid right there.
Okay.
My rules, my game.
Okay.
Walked past him. The man didn't really see my face. He saw my jacket. He later claimed I was wearing a leather jacket, but I was not. I was wearing a black fleece jacket. Mm-hmm. And I went through the showroom to the back showroom, and I sat on this katana, and I sat on it waiting for the guy to leave. I didn't even know the mom was even in the store.
Okay.
I didn't even know she was in the store. The ones I wanted was Scott, Brian, and Sherbert, the so-called mechanic, which really all he did was to change oil and mow the grass. But I didn't like any of them. They thought it was all fun and games to play this game with me, okay. You know, 3-4-on-1 nonsense. I don't do bullies. So I go to the back of the shop, sit on the bike. I am waiting for the guy and this kid to leave. They did leave. As soon as they left, I told Scott that I would take the motorcycle. I was confident of my shooting abilities. There was four people in that shop, three with guns, three males, three guns. I knew they carried guns. I had seen that they carried guns. I did not want to engage all four at one time. Did not think that would be technically sound, so I intentionally wanted to split them up. It was easier for me to go through the building rapidly mm-hmm. and take them somewhat broken apart. They wheeled the motorcycle to the back of the shop, which is where Schubert was putting oil on the bike and prepping it for sale, in the back of the back of the mechanic section.
Okay.
Well, I followed him. Once he started working on it, I went in through the doors. He was bent over the other side of the bike, working on something to do with the bike, the oil or something. And when I came up on the bike, I pulled out the Beretta, took the safety off, and I put 2 rounds through the back of him, through the back, down into his back and his chest. He drops, and that was it. Immediately turned right and went through the doors to go towards the front of the shop. I had other people I had to deal with. I knew they were either be calling the cops. I had no idea if other customers had come in the shop
right.
or who had left. Beverly had been in the bathroom, and when they heard the gunshots, she had come out of the bathroom. So when I opened the door, mm-hmm. when I came through that, Beverly was literally right in my face. And Scott was coming first. Well, Beverly was to my right, diagonally, like about 2 o'clock. Scott was in front of me, maybe 12 feet out, and behind him was Brian, maybe 4 feet behind me,
okay. Running
my way. I went ahead and pivoted. I pivoted right, shot Beverly in the heart. I swear I shot twice. I'm mm-hmm. guessing the other bullet, out of 18 rounds, I missed four times. She dropped. I turned on Scott. Brian pushed Scott in, tried to push Scott into me, pushing off to run away.
Mm-hmm.
Scott came forward. I put my hand up. He put the brakes on. And when he turned around, I lit him up. Put rounds down range. I missed three more times. I would say those two guys were fast, and they almost got to the door. Ran out of ammo. Those were back when we had 10-round magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Went ahead and did a reload. Got the slide back down and started sending again. And because I had had a pause, I had calmed down enough that I wasn't slapping the trigger. And I was getting back on target. And when Brian went through the door to get out, I shot him in the hip.
Okay.
Shot him in the hip and dropped him there. Scott went up his back, and he went out the door and ended up being in the parking lot. I went forth. As I came across Brian, I shot him in the head. I went out to the parking lot, and Scott was looking up. He was on his back. He was looking up. I didn't say two words to any of them. Mm-hmm. I had nothing to say. Everything I had to say that day was done with my trigger finger. The time for talking is over with.
Okay.
And I shot him in the forehead. So I shot him in the head. That was the end of him. Went back to the building again, shot Beverly in the head, and then went to the back of the building, and I shot Sherbert in the head.
Are you sure they're all dead? Then you bail out of there?
Everybody had been shot, and everybody had been shot in the head when I was done. Those headshots, they weren't going to get up from those. Mm-hmm. Everybody got shot in the head with a hydro shock. King Kong's not getting up from that one. Took me 30 seconds to get through the building the first time, 30 back, 30 again to the forward, because I had to double back when I did that. Getting in the car was about 15 seconds, and then I calmly drove out of the parking lot because I did not want to attract attention or spin my tires. Came down the road, took a few back roads, went home, took the gun apart, took the suppressor, took the ammo, the holster, everything, and I buried it in two big bags of cat litter. Nobody's going to dig through cat litter looking for something. There's nothing in there that you want to find. So that's why I buried it in cat litter, and then I threw those in the dumpster.
You got away with that, Todd, for like 13 years, and they probably would have never solved it if you didn't confess to that when you got arrested. They did not think you were a suspect, did they?
That is true.
Did they ever interview you? You're one of the customers. Did the police ever interview you as a possible suspect after the murders?
Never was interviewed.
So, Todd, you get away with that murder for 13 years. You attend college. You start Todd Kohlhepp & Associates real mm-hmm. estate company. You get your pilot license and you're flying planes. And things are going well for you. In fact, very well. You buy your property in 2014, 100 acres. You got it fenced. It cost probably $400,000 with the fence and everything. And but then things start spinning around, and you end up taking two people's lives, the Coxies. How does this happen?
The Coxies, I had been driving down the street on the way to get my mail at one of my post office boxes, mm-hmm. and I saw Megan Coxie on the side of the road, panhandling. Black Stock and Reval Road, right there by the I-26. So I saw her standing there panhandling. I'm going, okay, cute girl. I have a whole bunch of rental properties, and I don't clean houses. That's not my job.
Okay.
I'm always looking for workers, people who want to do cleaning, who want to do clean outs, repair work, mowing yards. I hire people all over the place. I saw a girl on the side of the road panhandling for money. And I went, great, I'll give a girl a job. Give me some good karma. She's kind of cute. Might get a little bit of play here. You never know. It's happened before. At the same time, at the very least, I don't have to clean some rentals. So there's really no loss. I pulled up beside her, rolled the window down, and informing her, look, I'm a real estate broker. Here's my business card. If you want some real work, not trying to make a pass at you, not trying to play games. If you want some real work, here's my card. I need some rentals cleaned. She got all excited and took my card. Later on, I went ahead and left. Later that night, she called the number, and we talked about I needed three rentals. So I'm not going to talk to you on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Not for long. Anyhow, there's cars behind me. Agreed to meet her at a parking lot across from where she lived. She didn't have a car. And there was a restaurant with one of my agents owned the restaurant across from where she lived. And there was a parking lot where a grocery store had gone out of business. So she met me over there. We talked, told her what I wanted. I wanted three places cleaned. This is what I want. Mm-hmm. She informed me that could she bring her boyfriend? I told her, I don't care who you bring. Understand that I only pay per job. I don't pay per person. I don't pay per hour. I told him, I said, I've got all the cleaning supplies, and I don't mind driving you out there so you don't have a car. If you do a good job, I got other ones you can do. But right now, I got three that need to be done before the first of the year so I can get them re-rented. She agreed, and then all of a sudden, she disappeared.
Okay.
I dropped them all. That was it. Figured we would contact the next day or so and get them on out there to go clean. Never heard from them. Come to find out, they both went to jail. Their baby tested positive for heroin. He went to jail. I didn't know what he looked like. I later on saw her face on the Go Upstate website of mugshots and went, I'll be damned. They got out of jail on Friday, and then she texted me, asked me if the job was still available. About an hour later, I was kind of pissed off because I had been delayed a whole week trying to figure out where the hell these people had been. Mm-hmm. Wasn't real happy about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Looks like we lost him. You there, Todd? So we lost Todd Kohlhepp. I'm sure he'll call back. I'm going to leave everything, keep recording here. Getting to the point where he kills the Coxies. Johnny Coxie is 29. Megan Coxie is 26. Well, we know they ended up buried on his property, I'm pretty sure. Megan was shot in the head. Johnny was shot in the torso, the chest. He may have kept Megan alive longer than Johnny. Maybe we continue this interview. We've got to get to the last three known murders. Another couple he interacts with and kills the man, Charlie. Charlie Carver, who's 32, and he kidnaps Caleb and keeps her in the storage container for 2 months.
Phil, Todd has killed many people, like a serial killer, but has also committed mass shootings, which is more like a mass murderer. What category would you put him in?
You know, in my 35 years of research, I've never come across a mass murderer and a serial killer in the same person. So in that aspect, he's extremely rare. Not only is that rare, but it's extremely rare to commit a mass murder and get away with it. People don't get away with mass murders. They're either apprehended, they kill themselves, or they're killed by the police. Todd Kohlhepp commits a mass murder and gets away with it. And in fact, he would have never gotten caught if he hadn't told the police that he was the perpetrator of that crime.
You know, Todd is just a really interesting and fascinating character. Just hearing him go through that motorcycle incident, he almost seems like a trained killer.
Todd Kohlhepp wants this kind of a perception that he's a trained killer. He's a Navy SEAL. He's Rambo. And as he tells his stories, you kind of get that from him. Like, he's really proud of the work he's done. He's a trained marksman. He knows a ton about guns, and he wants the world to know it.
He talks about murder like it's nothing, which isn't shocking considering the people we talk to on this podcast, but he shoots people in the head like it's not a big deal.
I think it goes back to he's so angry from his childhood. He's still angry as a 40-something-year-old man sitting in prison that he tells these stories with joy, that he got revenge on people that stood up to him. He got revenge on people that disrespected him. He got revenge on people that bullied him. When you listen to him talk about his crimes, he enjoys the hunt. He enjoys the act of murder. And he wants to tell you exactly what kind of rounds he used, what kind of bullets he used, what kind of guns he used, and where he shot each victim. Next, we're going to talk to Todd Kohlhepp about the murders that eventually got him locked up. We're going to talk about the double homicide of Johnny Coxey and Megan Coxey, and the homicide of Charlie Carver, as well as the kidnapping of Kayla. Todd Kohlhepp knew that he was killing people too close to him, and he knew he was going to get arrested for this, and he admitted that when I talked to him. Serial killers at the end of their crime spree get way too comfortable, and they start doing things that are very reckless. And when you kill someone that works for you, that's very reckless. These are the crimes that eventually got Todd Kohlhepp arrested.
Just want to remind you guys to go to the Crime Door app and download it while you listen to this episode. We want to remind you to go to the Crime Door app and download while listening to this episode to walk through the crime scene that eventually led to Todd Kohlhepp's arrest.
We're talking to Todd Kohlhepp. Up until this point, we've discussed his 15-year prison sentence for a rape he committed when he was only 15 years old. Soon after he was released from prison, he claims he was responsible for two murders, and those remain cold cases. He also walked us through the mass murder of four employees at a motorcycle shop in South Carolina. Why do we talk to these killers? We talk to them to find out what makes them tick and to potentially help solve cold cases. We're going to continue talking to Todd Kohlhepp. He's about to explain to us how he met the two victims he killed on his property, the Coxeys. They were begging and panhandling for money next to the side of the road. He saw them and he offered them a job to clean some of his homes. As a realtor, you need people to clean your properties, and he was always looking for that kind of help. When he saw Megan, who's attractive, and her husband, he thought, this is a bonus. I can get these two people to clean my homes for me, and I might get a little sex from Megan. So let's continue our conversation with Todd Kohlhepp as he describes how he kills the Coxeys. All right, we're back. We're back, and we're back recording. So
okay, so I picked him. I went ahead and agreed to meet him that morning, Saturday morning. I'll pick you up. We got to drive out to my land, which is about 8 miles away. Pick up all the supplies. I had a bunch of homes out there that I needed to get cleaned. One Inman, two Bowling Springs. Took him out to my land. We get to my storage building, and we are going through. I have shelves on both sides, and there are guns all over that building. There's guns everywhere. I've got a lot of my gun has a gun. I don't like being trapped, and I sure didn't want to have a building where all of a sudden, you've got a bunch of rednecks out there. I don't know what's out there. I've got a lot of money. I'm not going to have someone all of a sudden walk in behind me and thinking that all of a sudden, one guy out in the woods by himself and all this money sitting here. Wrong guy to walk up on because I'm going to kill you. I had retired. I had stopped all killing. I had stopped all killing. Mm-hmm. When I met my girlfriend and her kid, I decided I wanted to be a daddy. I didn't know how to do it, had no clue, but I was going to learn. And I stopped all the killing while I was around her and the kid.
Okay.
Knocked it off, let things go, walk away. The day that I took the Coxeys out to my land, we get out there, we're moving stuff, we're moving supplies to the SUV. And Johnny looks, he's got these humongous eyes. He looked like he was on something. I don't do drugs. I don't like drugs. I can't stand drug dealers. The guy was tweaking on something. So I'm getting the supplies. I'm keeping my eye on him because he does not look right. And Megan goes over to the bush hog, and she stands on top of the bush hog. I'm getting supplies. I got my back to Johnny, and all of a sudden I hear, now, Johnny. Now, later on, I wasn't sure if she said now or no, so I asked her, and she confirmed hours later that they had actually planned this and that the word was now. She was honest about it. I turned around, and when I turned around, Johnny's coming at me. He's about 12 feet away, and he's coming at me with his little pocket knife. The dude's coming at me with a knife. I reach over under the towel, grab the Glock, and I put two 180 grain federal hydro shocks in his chest. He drops. There's no argument. There's no warning. I don't say freeze. I'm not a cop. I put two rounds in his chest. He drops. Could not go to the outside towards the door. She stays on top of the bush hog. So I went between them and then got towards the door to block anybody from leaving. Because I don't know what the hell was going on, but he had just pulled a knife. And then I went ahead and shot a third time through his back. Because if I have to question if you're dead, ammo's cheap. I'm not. But she's just standing there. I put my hand up, and I'm pointing the gun at her. And she looks at me and goes, please don't rape me. Please don't hurt me. And I calmly told her, I says, ma'am, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to rape you. I just don't know what the hell y'all are doing. I need you to listen to me very carefully, and everything will be fine. I need you to come over here and lay down and put your hands out and cross your ankles. Mm-hmm. If you run, I will shoot you. She complied, went to the floor where I want her, lay down. I went, the tool chest next to her had handcuffs in it. I got the handcuffs, handcuffed her up, patted her down, sat down with her, and patted her to make sure I was in. I was like, what in the hell? Try to calm down with, okay, this is not what I expected for a Saturday morning. Why are you robbing me? Why are you trying to hurt me when I'm trying to give you cash for work?
Right.
I'm trying to pay you for a legit job. I'm not doing anything to you. You just happened to see me pull up in a $90,000 BMW, and you thought, well, I like your car. I want your car. I want your money. Well, you can't have it.
How long after that, Todd, did Megan die? How many hours, days?
6 days later, happened on the 19th.
Yep.
I shot her about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Christmas. Put the cuffs on her, she had the cuffs, and then I put her in my shipping container in the very back of the building. Had put her in the container. It was not designed for a dungeon. I mean, I had racks and racks of ammunition and guns outside of her reach.
You had Megan in the shipping container before you had Kayla, which is interesting. I never knew that.
Yes. Yes. Had her in there. There was no sex going on. There was nothing that went on for any of the time that she was there. Trying to figure out what to do with her, and had really no idea. Can't keep you. Don't want you. Can't turn you loose. I mean, I just shot your boyfriend, and once again, here I am, an ex-felon with a class 3 weapon, surrounded by a bunch of other class 3 weapons. Mm-hmm. There's no way I can explain this to law enforcement ever of why I have these guns and what is going on here. Mm-hmm. So I can't just let her. Christmas Day comes. I told her before Christmas, I came up with a bright idea that wasn't so bright. But I did not want to kill her, and I knew she was a junkie. Okay, so I told her, "Tell you what, I can't do anything while the weather's bad. But if you will just wait until it stops sleeting, when the weather clears up, I will pick a day. I will drive you to the other side of Tennessee, drop you off, give you $4,000 cash. You go left, I go right. You don't come back no more. Stay the hell out of South Carolina. Get a new start. Stay the hell away from me. Forget I exist." She gets all excited. "You're really going to do that?" "Yes. It cost me $4,000. I'm making almost $500,000 a year. $4,000 to make a problem go away is pocket change. Not a problem. Just please go away." She gets excited. Long story short, tries to entice me to give her more money. I'm like, "Look, I'm going to give you $4,000. That's all I'm going to give you. You don't have to do a damn thing for it. Just forget I exist." Mm-hmm. So we move forward. Christmas morning, I spent it with my girlfriend and her daughter. And then I decided that I need to go out to the land to check on Megan. Mm-hmm. And went on out there. As soon as I get to the shipping container, there is smoke coming out of the building. She lit the damn building on fire. That building has 200,000 rounds of ammunition, unbelievable amount of supplies, and enough guns to start a small war. I do not need that building on fire at all. Such the wrong building. Mm-hmm. I opened the front doors, and I thought she was dead. She had, as far as her chain would let her go, it was attached to her ankle. She had pushed over all the shelves. taken her lighter for her cigarettes, and she had lit toilet paper on fire and lit all of her bedding on fire and was sitting there in the middle of all the smoke, grinning and laughing. She thought it was just the best fun ever to start a fire. I'm like, oh, hell no. Oh, hell no. So I left her there, went outside, and I'm holding, once again, my shotgun. I'm standing there in the rain thinking, what in the hell am I going to do with you? You just aren't going to comply. You just try to light a building on fire with 200,000 rounds of ammo. Oh, no, you broke security here. I can't manage this. You got to go. So I went ahead, pulled the slide back on the weapon to put around the chamber, went back in the storage building, unhandcuffed her, and went to bring her on out the building. And in between the storage container and my shed, my green shed to the left, she went to walk between the buildings, and she goes to walk between the buildings, smiling like she was on her way to the mall, turns around, looks at me, smiles, comes back towards me, then turns back around to go back towards the garage, at which point I brought the pistol up and I put 180 grain hydro shock through the back of her head.
And she dropped, and did you bury her where her Johnny was?
About 20 feet to the left.
So
that was the end of Megan.
So that's the end of that, Todd. Then 8 months go by, and you have an interaction now with Charlie Carver and Kayla. Make that story really quick. How do you get with them, and how does Charlie end up dead?
I had known Kayla for about 5 or 6 years. She was dating and living with Dustin, who was my partner, who helped me get the guns. And I gave her a clean job of pruning my trees so I could drive my tractor underneath them. Anything 10 feet and below, just cut them down. Mm-hmm. And the job was to go out there and prune the trees. Got her out to my land, gave her the 3 foot pruning shears, gave Charlie a 3 foot set of pruning shears, and was going in the building to get him bottled water to go. I'm going to tell you where to go, and I'll be back in a couple hours. Mm-hmm. When I came around the corner, they were talking around the corner of the building, right there where the garage door was at the gap, mm-hmm. about stealing from me, and I got pissed off. Lost my cool about it. Mm-hmm. This was only eight months after Johnny and Megan.
Right.
I got pissed, walked back in, once again got a suppressed Glock, came out, shifted to the right, and I put two federal HSTs in Charlie's chest. And then when he hit the ground, I walked up on him and put a third round through his chest, aiming straight down. Mm-hmm. So I shot him 3 times. Kayla never made a noise. Kayla didn't move. Kayla didn't make a noise. I came up behind her. Tommy put my arm around her so she couldn't swing. She had the pruning shears, mm-hmm. so she couldn't swing them, mm-hmm. and put my, so she couldn't move them, and then told her, drop the shears. She did. She asked, the only thing she asked me is, what are you doing? I told her, I need you to go in the building, lay down, cross your ankles, put your hands out. Same thing with Megan. Took her in there, handcuffed her, went back out there to check on Charlie, came back in, checked on her, and I jumped the gun. There was no reason for me to shoot Charlie. He might have stolen some little knickknacks around the property, but it wasn't worth killing the man over. I just jumped the gun because of the previous situation.
And then you, just like you did Megan, you kept Kayla. It was kind of a same thing you did with Megan. You kept Kayla, but this time you had her for 2 months.
Kayla put, well, during the day, during the nighttime, overnight, she stayed in the shipping container. I went to PetSmart, got her two doggy beds, the Great Dane size doggy beds, mm-hmm. got her a little, a portable fan, a light, a clock.
Why'd you keep her alive? I mean, you had a lot of trouble with Megan. Why did you keep her alive? It seems like you would have just got rid of that, got rid of Kayla and moved on. What made you keep her alive?
I don't like killing women. I made a huge mistake as a kid when I kidnapped and raped Christy, the girl out in Arizona. I made a huge mistake. I was hugely embarrassed about it. I never want to do it again.
Todd, you kept her for 2 months. Unfortunately, the police were finally on to you, which is, you killed two people. You killed three people that were kind of close to you. I mean, like, you, there's a connection, which is pretty ballsy on your part. Police are on to you. They come to your house. There's video of you in your foyer, out your front door. They cut the locks and they save, they save Kayla out of the shipping container. And that all happens, I believe, on November 3rd, 2016. Is that the day you were arrested? November 3rd. When they're there, do you pretty much know the gig is up, Todd? It's over?
I knew it was up days before. The day that I shot, the day that I shot Charlie, I took the phones to Greenville to get them off the ping. I made a mistake. I knew I had all the passwords on. I opened them up, looked at what was on the phone. All I had to do was use the address book and dial a couple of numbers so it would re-ping in Greenville and then throw it out the window. Instead, I jumped the gun. I broke the phones in half, broke both phones in half, and I threw them out the window on 85. I had forgotten to ping the damn phones. So I already knew that high-end. I had screwed up that alibi.
So you knew.
Left
you
my
knew.
Land. So you I knew that. I screwed it up.
Right.
Days before I got arrested, I was at my land when they flew a drone over my land.
Okay.
I knew the drone was there. I saw the cops in the SUV doing it. I just stayed in the tree line until they were gone. I just really, at that point, the smart move would have been is just go ahead and shoot Kayla, hide the evidence, clean the scene, and there would have been nothing here. Instead, I was tired, and I just didn't feel like it. And my attitude was, fuck it.
So, Todd, you are arrested. You confess to seven murders. You get charged and convicted of seven murders, and you go off to the South Carolina Department of Corrections. You had said multiple times there are more murders, that you killed more than seven people. What do you think your number is?
Yes.
What is your number? Your
I have no idea. I have no idea. I didn't count. These were not trophies. These were not awards. These were not a scoreboard. I wasn't looking to make a certain number. Mm-hmm. I don't know where Kayla got her comment about 100 plus. There's no 100 plus. I mean, there's a lot of bodies. They're all criminals. Nobody was missing them. Nobody was missing these people. Mm-hmm. I don't pick people randomly off the street. I'm not going to just all of a sudden get pissed off at you and kill you. If you're not majorly in my face and doing something, I'm going to walk right on by you and let you go. If you're by yourself, I'm usually going to let you go. I have a problem when it becomes groups. Once there's two, three, four people involved, you want to play the bully game? I can play that. When there's groups there, I tend to react much differently with groups than I do individuals. Well, individuals, I'll give a pass.
What state?
Groups, I won't.
What states would these victims have been from?
There's a fair amount, although the number is considerably lower in here in the United States, mostly in the eastern United States.
Okay.
And then there was quite a few for a very brief period of time. I made five trips to Juarez, Mexico. But I was with other people when we went. This was not a solo act. I had briefly had an association with other individuals. I was not the leader. I was not the people. Mm-hmm. I will not tell you the names. Mm-hmm. But in regard, there was others involved. We went across the border, and we basically shot drug dealers, drug traffickers. Went in, shot them, threw the bodies and threw the drugs in a ravine, covered the ravine up with whatever was handy, and came back across the border.
So Todd, you are in prison. You've committed a mass murder. You've committed a serial killing spree. You're going to die in prison. You know this now. What would you like to say? Mm-hmm. What is your message from you to the world? Like, Todd, what do you have to say to people that are going to listen to this?
I really don't have anything to say. I've got no statement. I mean, I did what I felt I had to do at the time. I'm not going to rationalize and go, you know, it's not my fault. It was my trigger finger, my choice. Mm-hmm. It's on me. I'm not going to blame my bad childhood. We all had bad childhoods. Some people were taught a little differently. Some had it worse. Some had it better. The more violence you use, after a while, it becomes the only tool in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up, you have many tools, a lot of selection. Later on, you realize, you know what, that hammer solves a lot of problems, and everything became a nail.
Are you remorseful for your crimes at all, Tom?
No. No. Regret and remorse are not the same. I wished I had gone down a different path. I wish I had let things go. I should have walked away from the bike shop. I should have walked away from the bike shop and said, you know what, screw you guys, and let it go. I should have been the bigger person, and I wasn't. I should have let that one go. I am sorry that I shot Charlie. Screw Johnny. When I get to hell, I'm going to kill him again. So to hell with Johnny. As far as it goes with Charlie, I never should have shot that man. I should have, at the very most, fired him. I should have gone, you know what, never mind, put the shears down, go home, you're fired. That would have been an appropriate response, but I overreacted drastically. It was right there where I had shot Johnny. And with Johnny, I had hesitated. I had hesitated because I really wasn't wanting to engage that. I had been murder-free, 12-step. Mm-hmm. I had been murder free for quite a few years, and the rust came off very rapidly. The next with Charlie, I went the other direction,
right,
and I overreacted. I went from hesitation to overreaction.
So Todd, I hopefully you and I could do some more things together, and maybe we can solve a couple cold cases down the road. And I appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Cool. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Todd.
So, Phil, something that stands out to me with Todd's crimes, and obviously this was the key to his demise and the key to him getting arrested, was he murdered Charlie, but he kept Kayla, Charlie's girlfriend, alive, chained in like a storage container. And from what I understand, this is because he felt bad, like he didn't feel like she needed to die. But can you explain this? Why, after murdering so many people and not having any remorse for killing people, he chooses this one girl to keep alive? And obviously, that kind of led him to getting arrested.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. First of all, you know, the people who are present at these crimes, there's only one person left alive, and it's Todd Kohlhepp. So we really don't know exactly what happened. But he has a justification for all of his murders. So supposedly, the two men in these two couples were trying to rob him, stab him, attack him, so he killed them. I personally think there's more to the story than he's telling us. I believe these were sex crimes. I believe he killed the men and kept the women later. First young lady, Megan Coxey, was chained up in the storage container as well as Kayla. And I believe he kept them for sexual reasons. I believe he used a gun to threaten them. And he just doesn't want to be that guy. He wants to be a killer, but not a rapist. I mean, he's got a rape in his history. It is part of who he is. And kept Kayla around for sex and would eventually kill her later. He just was enjoying it and he thought he'd gotten away with it. You see, it took the police 2 months to get onto him. So I would guess after a week, you probably thought you got away with another murder. And I had asked him several times, why did you not kill Kayla? I mean, the police show up at the property and they find her, you're done. Kayla has no idea how lucky she is. Kayla should not be alive. The fact that she is a complete miracle. It goes against everything Todd Kohlhepp is about.
One of the things that Todd said that really stuck out to me was that he crossed the Mexican border to apparently kill drug dealers. I mean, is he talking about the cartel?
Here's what we know Todd Kohlhepp has done. He's killed three victims and buried them on his property, and he had a woman in a storage container. That's what we know for sure. The rest of it, you have to be skeptical about it. Who flies a plane to Mexico and kills members of the cartel and lives to talk about it? This could be another one of Todd Kohlhepp's fantasies where he's Rambo, he's a Navy SEAL, and he's killing bad guys. In a sense, he's the real-life Dexter.
You know, we've talked to many serial killers on this last season and on this season that were long-haul truck drivers and had various jobs. Never have I heard of someone that has a college education with several degrees, is super successful as a real estate agent. I mean, talk about a job where you're interacting with so many people and you have access to their homes, keys to their residences, and you have staff. I mean, he has to function in society and deal with lots of people day to day. It's not like a long-haul truck driver where you're just alone in your truck.
what I would say to people when they ask me questions like that is, you know how all serial killers are similar? They're all different. You can't lump anybody into any category, right? Like, so we saw Delmas Colvin. He just killed people when they made him mad. He happened to be a truck driver, but he had a successful trucking company. There's been serial killers who worked in computer fields and stuff like that. Todd Kolip is a killer businessman, right? He's a businessman. He's got college degrees. He owns the real estate company. He doesn't work for a real estate company. He owns the real estate company. He has 12 people that work for him. But as you listen, and I'm hearing more and more stories of his clients and buyers and sellers and other realtors, they would always say, you know, something wasn't right with him. He watched porn at the office. He talked about guns all the time. He's told people I've killed people. I mean, at some point you've got to say, you know, this might not be him telling stories. This could be a warning sign. Maybe we should tell somebody. A convicted felon and sex offender is not supposed to own weapons, yet he bragged about his weapons all the time, and a lot of people knew he had a cache of weapons at home.
You know what's fascinating is that you think that someone who's a registered sex offender, that would follow them, that it's something that's accessible. And when I think about how many people that I must come across in my everyday life who could possibly be registered sex offenders and could be violent criminals, and I wouldn't even know it.
How do you become a real estate agent when you're a convicted felon? I mean, you're not supposed to get your real estate license when you're a convicted felon. How does he pass the test and get a real estate license? When it comes to the Superbike murders, he got away with that crime for 13 years until he confessed. But he should have been a suspect. He was one of the persons that bought a motorcycle at the shop. He was one of the persons that's been back there several times, and he had some beef with the workers and the owner. There was a guy in the bike shop that saw him there. And by the time that man left and got home, there was a report that everybody was dead at the bike shop. He should have never slipped through the cracks. But when you're so normal and you're so successful, people just have the little inkling, like, could it be? And then they just kind of go, no, it can't be him. That is how serial killers get away with their murders. Todd Kolhep is serving 7 consecutive life sentences in the South Carolina Department of Corrections. Todd Kolhep will never be a free man again. Todd Kolhep will leave the South Carolina prison in a box. Thanks for listening to Where the Bodies Are Buried. And remember to subscribe to receive updates on new episodes. This podcast is produced by Grinning Dog Entertainment and Audio Up.